Penguin Random House Audio presents Victoria the Queen, an intimate biography of the woman who ruled an empire, by Julia Baird. Read for you by Lucy Rayner.
Queen Victoria did not belong to any conceivable category of monarchs or of women. She bore no resemblance to an aristocratic English lady. She bore no resemblance to a wealthy middle-class Englishwoman, nor to any typical princess of a German court. She reigned longer than the other three queens put together. Never in her life could she be confused with anyone else, nor will she be in history. Such expressions as "people like Queen Victoria," or "that sort of woman," could not be used about her. For over 60 years she was simply, without prefix or suffix, the Queen. Arthur Ponsonby. We are all on the lookout for signs of illness in the Queen, but the vein of iron that runs through her most extraordinary character enables her to bear up to the last minute, like nobody else. Lady Lyttelton. Introduction. One feels that the Queen is a woman to live and die for. Emily Tennyson. Such a little vixen. Reverend Archer Clive. She was ready. But when Victoria first sat on the throne, her feet did not touch the floor. Below the soaring arches of Westminster Abbey, she was a mere dot, burning under the curious gaze of the gathered crowd, trying not to dangle her legs. Thousands thronged the streets of London before sunrise, hoping to claim a vantage point from which to glimpse Britain's new queen, who was just 18 years of age and less than 5 feet tall. The previous kings had been profligates, philanderers, opium-addled, or mad. Now the country was infatuated with the fair white rose of perfect womanhood, their new ruler, the tiny teenager who was sitting uncomfortably in a large abbey, festooned with gold drapes and exotic carpets, as diamond-laden aristocrats stared at her. Victoria's head ached under a heavy crown, and her hand throbbed. The ruby coronation ring had been jammed onto the wrong finger. It was later, painfully, removed with ice. Around her stood her older male advisers, in a state of disrepair. Her prime minister was half-stoned with opium and brandy, ostensibly taken to calm his stomach, and he viewed the entire ceremony in a fog. Her archbishop, having failed to rehearse, jumbled his lines. One of her lords tumbled down the steps when he approached to kiss her hand. But Victoria's composure was impeccable. Her voice was cool, silvery, and steady. Once, the thought of becoming queen had terrified her, but as she grew, she had longed to work, to be independent, and to have some control over her life. And what she dreamed of most of all was sleeping alone, in her own room, and escaping her mother's suffocating hands. Most teenagers are given an allowance. She was given a kingdom. Few would have bet Victoria would become Queen of the British Isles. Her father, after all, was not the first son of a king, but the fourth. It was, as so often with inherited power, due only to a series of tragedies, the deaths of family, including infants, a woman giving birth, and two corpulent uncles, as well as luck. Her soldier father avoiding being murdered by mutinous troops, and somehow persuading her mother to marry a middle-aged, almost bankrupt prince, that on June the 20th, 1837, the destiny of a nation wheeled, spun, and came to rest on the small frame of an 18-year-old girl. A girl who read Charles Dickens, worried about the welfare of gypsies, adored animals, loved to sing opera, was fascinated with lion tamers and hated insects and turtle soup. A girl who was bullied by those closest to her until her determination set like concrete. A girl whose heart was wound tight with cords of sentiment and stoicism. It had not been simple. Before she reached the age of one, Victoria lost her father. Before she turned 18, she had become estranged from her mother. Many times the crown almost slipped from her grasp. Others had tried to wrest it from her for years. She had needed to draw on the innate iron vein in her character and cultivate a stubborn strength. But the toddler who stamped her feet, the child who slammed piano lids, and the teenager who stared down tormentors was now queen. The first thing she did when she got home from her coronation was to give her dog a warm, sudsy bath, laughing as he flicked soap onto her face and clothes. We forget, now, how long Victoria ruled alone. She may have married Albert only a couple of years after she was crowned, but following his death, she ruled for 39 years on her own. Yet we know little about this period. This is largely because of the enormous, enduring spectacle of her grief. To walk the streets of London today is to be reminded that Victoria mourned loudly and for a long time. It is clear to anyone, then and now, that she loved her German husband with a particular intensity. A sudden love that took her by surprise and lasted until her death. 2 decades after Albert died, she was still erecting memorials. In Hyde Park, his muscular statue juts into the sky, with strong golden thighs, surrounded by angels and the virtues, looking godlike. Victoria never fully recovered, and when she later found happiness in the company of another man, she guiltily consulted a priest. Yet the great volume of Victoria's grief meant that a myth sprang up almost immediately, which many still believe today. That she stopped ruling when Albert died, and that she had abdicated almost all of her authority and power to her clever husband when he was alive. When she was crowned, people were amazed that Victoria could think clearly and speak without stumbling. When she married, they were convinced she had deferred all major decisions to Albert. And when he died, she was castigated as a remote, grieving widow. All this is wrong. Queen Victoria was a decisive ruler who complained of the weight of her work while simultaneously bossing prime ministers about daily, if not hourly. "The Queen alone," said Prime Minister Gladstone, "is enough to kill any man." Yet our generation, almost as much as the Victorian, seems to fail to understand how such a woman could wield power ably and with relish. Part of the reason for this failure is the sheer difficulty of digging through the mass of legend and hyperbole to reach the real Victoria. To properly understand this task, we must fly back to May the 10th, 1943, when the Second World War was raging. On this day, Adolf Hitler extended his dictatorship indefinitely. American troops were preparing to oust Japan from islands in Alaska, and Winston Churchill was arriving in Washington for a critical meeting with Franklin D. Roosevelt, a day before the Axis powers surrendered to the Allies in North Africa. 86-year-old Beatrice, Victoria's daughter, sat down in her home in Sussex, England, trembling. Decades earlier, she had been charged with the unfortunate task of editing the Queen's voluminous diaries. She did this over 10 years, writing them out in her own hand into blue copybooks and burning the originals in one of the greatest acts of historical censorship of the century. Now she was an elderly woman who was occupying herself with translating her family archives as a distraction from the anxieties of war. That day, she pulled out a sheet of stationery to write a beseeching letter never before published, to her great...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?